It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin and the U.S. do not have the same social safety net policies as other high-income countries, and that shifts more of the responsibility on the individual to overcome personal hardships.
Sociologist Jessica Calarco says this system is a disadvantage to women in particular. Her new book offers detailed accounts from new mothers who are scraping by and lays out our society relies on women a lot to keep the economy running.
Calarco is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Her research team followed families for 4 years and conducted national surveys involving thousands of parents. The book is called Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Jessica, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the book, you describe our country as being a DIY society, a do-it-yourself society, everyone expected to solve their own problems, their own hardships. What does that look like from the framework of how we go about our lives in this country?
Sure. So essentially, other countries have invested in social safety nets to help people manage risk. They use taxes and regulations, especially on wealthy people and corporations, to protect people from falling into poverty, give people a leg up in reaching economic opportunities, and really ensure that everyone has the time and energy and incentive to contribute to a shared project of care, to take care of their families, their homes, themselves, their communities. In the U.S., we've instead tried to DIY society. You know, we keep taxes low, we keep our social safety net as threadbare as possible. And we tell people that if they just make good choices, they shouldn't really need that safety net at all. And the problem there is that you can't actually DIY society. Forcing people to manage all that risk on their own has really just left families and communities kind of teetering on the edge of collapse. And at the same time, we haven't collapsed in part because we have women kind of holding it together, filling in the gaps both in our economy, filling the kinds of low-wage jobs that are often difficult to fill for employers, and also filling in gaps in the safety net, you know, doing the default caregiving for children and for the sick and for the elderly in our communities.
What's remarkable about the book is we go deeply into the lives of some of the people you and your research team interviewed, like Akari, who is managing, you know, 3 part-time jobs after her partner killed by gun violence, and stringing all of these jobs together and then doing jobs in manufacturing on the weekend. What is it like for a woman like Akari to try to patchwork together multiple jobs?
Sure. And certainly this is not an easy situation for her. She talked about how, I mean, she went from being a stay-at-home mom to having to work 3 jobs to make ends meet for her family. And the irony is that it wasn't even that she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom in the first place. She was pushed into it because, you know, when her children were born, she and her partner earned too much to qualify for any childcare subsidies, but not enough to afford to pay for childcare. And because her income was lower than her partner's, it made more sense to sacrifice her paid work. And so, like most stay-at-home moms in the U.S., she was kind of forced into filling this role, filling this gap in the childcare system. And then when her partner was kind of suddenly and tragically killed, she had to figure out, you know, how do I keep a roof over my kid's head? She didn't have a job, didn't have access to substantial savings. And she talked about how, you know, kind of going from one job to another, just to try to make ends meet, it added to emotional stress that her family was facing in the wake of her partner's death. She talked about how her daughter had PTSD in part from her father's death, and also from the fact that in her mind, she lost both of her parents, that she went from having, you know, a stay-at-home mom who was there all the time to almost never getting to see her kids or getting to see her mom because, you know, they barely had any time together between the almost 60 hours a week that Akari was working just to be able to keep a roof over their heads.
The red flag here was that her hours were capped, that employers kept her hours lower. What did that allow them to circumvent?
Sure. So the way that the Affordable Care Act works in the U.S. is that employers are incentivized to both push workers into part-time roles that don't hit that sort of cap, that don't have requirements attached to them to provide health insurance for their employees, and also to keep workers as contractors rather than kind of official or kind of have official employees with on their books. And so what that meant was that many of the kinds of jobs that Akari was able to find when she started looking for paid work, and she actually needed to find paid work to be able to qualify for welfare payments because we have work requirements, the jobs were often very low wage, very part-time jobs in retail that simply didn't pay enough to make ends meet. And so kind of running up against those caps made it incredibly difficult for her to find not only jobs that would pay her substantial incomes or offer opportunities to move up, but also jobs that would offer any sort of benefits, things like health insurance that she needed for her family as well.
You mentioned work requirements, and in safety net programs and here in Wisconsin, ensuring that people who are on these types of welfare programs are also earning and having a job. How does that work out? Does that lead to better employment?
It usually doesn't. Unfortunately, the research on that front shows that these kinds of work requirements typically operate to funnel low-income, especially low-income women, disproportionately women of color, into the kinds of low-wage jobs that employers struggle to fill, that this doesn't lead to long-term stable employment or to the kinds of jobs that offer opportunities for real growth or for real savings over time. And that's in part because, and at the same time, women often get stuck in these jobs even after they run out of eligibility for welfare. In Wisconsin, for example, you can only be on welfare for 2 years at a time and only 5 years over the course of your lifetime. And so that means that many women, you know, end up struggling and stuck in these kinds of jobs because they're the best options available to them, particularly when they're also trying to rely on things like welfare.
Another story is Brooke. And Brooke gets recruited to work at her child's daycare, which means free daycare, but Brooke working at minimum wage. And the salary was like $25,000. Can you talk about that catch of women wanting to work and yet childcare is the thing that holds them back, the barrier?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the kinds of childcare subsidies that we have available for families are often only available to very low-income families in our communities. And they're also not available to, you know, things like college students who might want to continue their education while being able to, you know, have their children in childcare. And that's essentially what happened to Brooke. She actually didn't want to have children herself. She'd grown up in a very kind of difficult home life. And yet, like many young women, she ended up getting unintentionally pregnant in college. And she initially planned to get an abortion, but her mom talked her out of it, said, we'll help you, you know, we'll help you care for the baby and we'll help you stay in college. But ultimately, they figured out that they couldn't afford to pay for both college and for childcare. And so Brooke ended up, you know, dropping out of college and going on welfare and trying to find the first job that she could. And, you know, she started in a retail job, but that, you know, paid very little money and was incredibly stressful. And she ended up taking a job in childcare because she talked about how at the time childcare was costing her almost as much as rent, even with the subsidies that she qualified for. And so this was, you know, not the job that she envisioned for herself. She did like it. But even when she got promoted to assistant director of the center, she was even then still only making $25,000 a year and didn't have access to employment benefits, in part because, you know, small businesses are also exempt from things like the ACA requirements and from things like even unpaid leave requirements for things like family and medical leave. And so this was, you know, difficult for Brooke in the sense that she wanted to go back to college, wanted to have access to those opportunities, but couldn't find a way to make childcare work for herself in ways that she could, you know, not only keep a roof over her family's head, but also be able to invest in the kinds of opportunities she wanted long term.
We're talking with UW-Madison sociologist Jessica Calarco about her new book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Jessica, you look at countries, Scandinavian countries, where there are these robust social support systems. Do you think that we can take those programs and make them work here in our country based on the economy we have now?
Yes, I think we have strong evidence to suggest that these kinds of safety net programs could work here. I mean, we have examples like Social Security and Medicare, which, you know, yes, have not been funded maybe to the level that they need to be, but show that it's possible for us to do large scale social safety net programs that are incredibly successful at lifting people out of poverty, improving health outcomes, and kind of operating at a broad scale level. And even, you know, during, I talk in the book about during World War II, we put in place a large scale childcare program to help raise women's employment when we had large numbers of men off fighting in battle. And it was highly effective at increasing workforce participation rates among women and helping to provide high quality care for, you know, children across the U.S. And so it's certainly possible to do those kinds of, to put in place those kinds of changes here. And we actually got fairly close with Build Back Better. We had policies, and even during the pandemic, we, you know, dramatically cut the rate of child poverty in the U.S. through things like the child tax credits. And many of the families that I talked to, things like the student loan moratoriums or rent relief programs during the pandemic, or even the COVID stimulus payments, made a huge difference for many of these families. And so these programs are possible and feasible, and we have the resources to do so. Those resources are often just consolidated in the wrong hands.
One of the stats, and you have many numbers and statistics in the book, but more than 70% of U.S. adults believe that hard work alone, not luck or help from other people, determines who gets ahead in our society. How does that mentality affect what you see in the safety net?
Sure. So I talk about this as sort of the meritocracy myth. And many people in the U.S., in part because of the kinds of cultural messages that have been promoted in our society for decades, have come to believe that we don't really need a social safety net, because if people just work hard enough and have the right mindset, they'll be able to succeed no matter what kinds of challenges that they face. And you know, this has been promoted by lots of different, everything from business groups to think tanks to kind of politicians in our society. And it's a sticky idea, because in the context of high levels of inequality, like what we have in the U.S., it's psychologically reassuring to believe that if you just work hard enough, you'll be able to be successful. But one of the problems that comes with this kind of attitude is that it leads even people who would benefit from a stronger social safety net to decide, you know what, maybe we shouldn't have that net, because that allows them to have a sense of moral superiority over people who are a little bit worse off than they are. And I talk about a mom who I call April, who's a white evangelical Christian mom, who she's a stay-at-home mom, and they get by on about $30,000 a year from her husband's income as a pastor at their church. And yet April says, you know, she opposes things like universal childcare, universal health care, raising the minimum wage, paid family leave, in part, and talking, kind of digging in and asking her where this sort of opposition comes from. She judged other families, and especially other women who rely on these kinds of government programs, implying that if families need to rely on those programs, it must be because they're making, you know, bad financial choices. And then she often even drew on sort of racist and sexist stereotypes, saying those moms must be going out and getting their nails done or going out and partying and hiring babysitters. And at the same time, so essentially by rejecting the need for a social safety net and by buying into this idea that hard work and good choices alone can guarantee success, April allowed herself to sort of feel better, to feel a sense of superiority, even though that meant denying herself the kind of social safety net that her family arguably needs and also deserves.
Jessica, how do you see the role of organized labor factoring in here? How having a right to work laws like those in Wisconsin affect the landscape for women and the work life and what they can earn?
Sure. So we know that unions, labor unions, are one of the strongest tools that we have in our arsenal to help protect workers and ensure that people not only have access to the kinds of financial resources that they need to avoid precarity and have opportunities for their families, but also to make sure that they have access to the time and energy that they need to participate in, you know, the shared project of unpaid caregiving labor. You know, we can outsource some parts of our care work, but we can't outsource everything. We'll always need to care for loved ones around us and spend time with them and, you know, care for our homes. And I'm guilty of having a giant pile of unfolded laundry, you know, that needs to be put away, and I just don't have the time to do it. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that labor unions can not only fight for better paid benefits, but also for time, to ensure that workers have the time and energy to be able to contribute to their communities and to their families. And certainly the kinds of laws that we've seen not only in Wisconsin, but in many other states that have tried to chip away at union bargaining to limit the power of unions have operated to dramatically increase inequality in those kinds of states and make it harder for workers to bargain not only for better wages and better benefits, but also for the kinds of time protections that they need to be contributing more actively at home.
You end the book saying, imagine a world where we value care work on par with IT. What would that world look like to you?
Sure. So, and I use that example in part because I talk about a couple in the book where, before they had kids, she was a social worker and he was working in IT, and she was making, despite having a higher level of education than he did, only $30,000 a year, and he was making 90. And so what that meant for them as a couple was that when it came time to make decisions about who would sacrifice their paid work to be the default parent, for example, when they had kids, it almost seemed like a no-brainer to them that she would be the one to sacrifice her paid work to care for the kids or to fill in the gaps when the pandemic hit, for example. And so I use IT as an example there, not because it's, not valuable work, but because it's often, valued so much more than the kinds of caregiving jobs that disproportionately fall to women, where IT work is disproportionately done by men. And so in practice, what that would mean if we were to value that kind of caregiving labor, we would treat it, we would recognize that that kind of caregiving labor is often underpaid because it doesn't work well with our sort of profit-driven kind of free market economy, in the sense that things like social work, it's almost all labor, and it's work that is needed by people who don't have the resources to be able to pay for it themselves. And so essentially that means that, if we're going to make that work viable, we have to invest in it as a public good. And that means higher government investments of tax dollars in services from social work to education to childcare to healthcare, to make that kind of work not only viable for the people who do it, but also funded to the level where it's high quality care for the people who need it in our society. So that's, one big piece of the equation is valuing care work in ways that make that work sustainable and high quality, and also putting in place protections where people can participate in the unpaid caregiving labor as well, having limits on paid work hours, ensuring that people have protected paid time off and protections on that front to be able to have more time with their families, have more time to volunteer in their communities, to help on those sort of more informal parts of the caregiving equation as well.
One more thing with that pile of laundry that is unfolded, mine mound on the mound as well. You could have offered self-help tips here to women. You could have given your insights on how you can be scrappy and pull this together. Why didn't you go that direction?
I mean, I think it's important. I see the role of sociology in particular, and as a sociologist, as sort of un-gaslighting people, to help them to recognize that the kinds of challenges that they face in their lives are often the product of social structures and social forces that are so big that they're hard to see from an individual vantage point. And so my goal with this book is sort of to help people to see those structures in ways that can help them to avoid, and particularly women, to help avoid blaming themselves when they struggle and to let go of some of that guilt, but also to push women, especially through kind of seeing the kinds of stories that are in the book, to not only recognize themselves in those stories, but to better see other people. I think in addition to guilt, we're often encouraged to kind of judge and blame each other. And my hope is that through a book like this one, people will be able to better understand why people are struggling, even if their circumstances are very different from their own, and also to recognize how in those shared struggles are opportunities for connection. And that we can start to reject some of the myths, things like the myth of meritocracy, that are designed not only to delude us into believing that we don't need a social safety net, but also to divide us by race and class and gender and politics and religion in ways that try to prevent us from coming together to demand a better social safety net, rather than just trying to do what we can to maximize our own individual success or the success of our kids often as well.
Jessica, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lovely conversation.
Jessica Calarco is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Madison, and she was with us today to share her new book. It's called Holding It Together: How Women Became America's Safety Net.